Welcome to Earth 2, a world amazingly like the Earth we're all familiar with, yet with surprising differences.
Clark Kent is editor of the Daily Star and married to its top reporter, Lois Lane.
This story takes place years ago, early in the wedded life of
Mr. and Mrs. Superman.
When a couple decide to take that big leap and get wed, they still might have some doubt about what they might have done instead. To leap into the future together and wonder what it all will bring, it might be a whole lot easier to leap a tall building. But if anyone can achieve that feat, we bet these two sure can. Now, we'd like you to meet Mr. and Mrs. Superman.
Hello, and welcome to Justice Society Presents, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, and the third installment of a series covering the Mr. and Mrs. Superman feature. I'm Cindy Franklin.
And I'm Chris Franklin, and we're back again, pretty soon after last time. On this series within Justice Society Presents series, we covered the Mr. and Mrs. Superman feature. This was one of several features that ran in Superman Family during its Dollar Comics phase of the late 70s, early 80s.
It was set during the 1950s and focused on the early wedded days of Clark Kent and Lois Lane of Earth 2, the original Golden Age version of comics' first couple as newlyweds.
Since this is Justice Society Presents, our primary focus here is to cover stories that feature guest appearances by and tie-ins to other JSA members, which this one does, although in a pretty unique way, at least until the last two panels. The comic panel heavy cover of Superman Family No. 206, April 1981, by Ross Andrew and Dick Giordano, focuses on Supergirl in the center, as usual, with figures of her in the Earth 1 versions of Jimmy Olsen and Lois Lane on the left. Lois, Jimmy, and Clark Kent also receive vignettes from their stories that are inside, but we're interested in the vignette at the bottom left of the cover, which states, "Guest villains, the Harlequin End, ?" and another caption that reads, "Who is the secret menace to Mr. and Mrs. Superman?" We see a figure hidden behind the ugly UPC box in shadow while Superman, Lois, and the Harlequin look shocked. So what do you think of this cover?
Again, just like the other one before, yes, there's a lot going on here, but the way they present it is very clean.
Right.
You know, it's distinct stories.
Right, so. Right, exactly. It tells you that this is all that's inside this book, and there's a lot going on inside this book. So, you know, spend your dollar and be entertained.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The story is Hostage of the Harlequin, writer E. Nelson Bridwell, penciler Kurt Schaffenberger, inker Dan Atkins, letterer Milt Snappen, colorist Adrian Roy, and the editor was Julia Schwartz.
Lois argues with her editor-slash-husband, Clark Kent, that she should get the assignment covering the recent robbery of gold and silver medals from the Metropolis Stadium, linked to Green Lantern's foe, the Harlequin. Lois reminds him of how many scoops she had while he battled supervillains, and he reminds her of how many times he had to save her from those villains. Lois points out that the special jewel in her ring will signal impulses to Clark's superhearing if she grows anxious or in a state of fear. Clark eventually relents and gives her the assignment.
Lois snoops around the stadium and finds the thieves have returned looking for a lost lighter one of them dropped. Lois is knocked unconscious and is nearly shot when the Harlequin appears, using her special glasses to stop the gunman, saying the sound of the gunshot would draw attention to them. Harlequin recognizes Lois as Superman's friend and decides to use her as a hostage, but first secretly removes her rings and drops them in her mandolin. Lois awakens to find her rings and her ability to alert Superman gone.
Harlequin and her goons take Lois to their headquarters in an abandoned sporting goods store and call their boss, whom Harlequin has never met. More of the gang arrives, including a bearded name named Cal and their boss, Crusher Croc, a.k.a. the Sportsmaster. He admits he was running things in secret to set up a trap for Harlequin, wanting revenge on her for betraying his team, the Injustice Society of the World. When Croc attempts to shoot her with a modified starter pistol, the gun glows red and turns hot, and Cal reveals himself as Superman in disguise. The Man of Steel takes out the gang and dunks Croc in a basketball net. Harlequin escapes, but she leaves her mandolin, allowing Lois to recover her rings. In walks Green Lantern, who tells Lois, off the record of course, that Harlequin is really an undercover agent for the police. He feared she was about to stumble into a trap and called Superman for an assist. Lois agrees to keep Harlequin's secret.
What did you think of this one?
It was fun, but there's some nitpicky things that we're going to talk about.
Okay. Well, I will say I like seeing the Harlequin in Sportsmaster, but I can't help but feel Green Lantern just walking in at the last minute is a real missed opportunity.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Why not have him in disguise, too, or when Superman takes off his disguise, he comes out of hiding and takes out some of the gang with his ring, you know, make some constructs and things.
That was my
even
thing.
Some sports constructs to, yeah, you know, to like he makes a goal and like kicks some guys like through, like makes a big foot and kicks them through it or something, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it's
that was, I mean, you know me, I love me some Alan Scott Green Lantern.
Sure, yeah.
He's my favorite Green Lantern.
Yeah, even more than John Stewart?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. See, John Stewart is now supplanted.
Well, I don't know, because John Stewart on Justice League, you know, the animated series and everything. I mean, I love him, but I love Alan's. You know, it just.
Yeah, I know. It's hard. Yeah. You don't have to pick. It's not an absolute thing. You can like one more than the other at different times.
Okay. Good.
Yeah.
The other nitpicky thing I have is if Harley Quinn, you know, if she is an undercover cop and stuff, why did she take Lois's rings off?
Well, I think she took them off so they wouldn't steal them. That's what I got from it. That's why she hit him, so she wouldn't. They would steal him off of her.
Okay, and then also Cal-El. Hello, let's telegraph.
Yeah,
what our name really is. You know.
Yeah, well, we'll get back to the ending and all that in a little bit. Let's talk a bit about our guest players.
Sorry.
No, you're fine. The Harlequin first appeared in the Green Lantern strip in All-American Comics number 89, created by writer Robert Kaniger and artist Irwin Hasson, who we met once.
Yes,
years
we
ago.
Did.
Yeah, he actually signed my Alan Scott t-shirt, along with Martin Noddle.
Yes, and we also have a
button from Martin Noddle.
Yep,
we do. Not Martin O'Dell, I think. O'Dell's the proper name to say the creator Green Lantern. Sorry about that. But yeah, yes, we do. We met. I got to tell this story. I don't know if I've ever told this on a podcast. And Rob had Irwin Hasson as a teacher at the Kubert School. But we went to this comic convention, and Julius Schwartz and Irwin Hasson were sitting right. I don't know if they were supposed to be at the same table, but he was there.
Yeah.
Talking to Julie. And, of course, they worked together for years. And, you know, he worked on the – Julie was the editor on the JSA strip, and he was an artist and Green Lantern and everything. And I brought up Roy Thomas's All-Star Companion book, mm-hmm. the first volume, for them to sign, because I thought, well, that'd be a great book for them both sign, you know. And there's a picture of Julie as a young man in there, and he still looks like Julius Schwartz. I mean, he's still balding, you know, he just looks younger. He looked the same. But Irwin Hasson's like, looks at it, takes one look, looks at him, goes, "You were one handsome mother..." I about died. I mean, I was just like, I kind of chuckled, and Julius Schwartz just kind of gave him a look. He kind of had that gruff persona that you expect as when he appeared in the comics, but he was friendly. It's great. I feel lucky that I got to meet those guys, because they're all gone now.
Yeah.
You know, but anyway, she was created by Robert Kaniger and Irwin Hasson. I never have, if you say Hasson or Hasson, I don't know which one's the correct way. Rob, tell me, you would know. Molly Maine was the secretary of radio executive Alan Scott, a.k.a. Green Lantern, and she assumed the villainous identity of the Harlequin for a radio drama which Green Lantern was set to star in. She instantly fell in love with the hero, who told her he had no time for romance. This spurred Molly Maine to adopt the Harlequin identity for real in an attempt to attract Green Lantern's attention. Neither Scott or Maine guessed the other's secret identities across her various appearances in All-American, Green Lantern's own title, and Comic Cavalcade. She eventually made a deal with the FBI to help them find certain criminals and evidence, but according to her Who's Who entry, which says, "But despite past accounts, never became an agent for them." So that's Roy Thomas probably writing that entry for her, saying, no, she was never an agent of the police, despite what E. Nelson Bridwell wrote in that Superman family story.
Right.
That nerd fight. Nerd fight, you know, it's like, well, actually, she was never really an agent of the police, you know? Worst episode ever. Molly, sometimes just as Alan's secretary, made 16 appearances in the Golden Age, most of them by Kaniger and Hasson. She did join the Injustice Society of the World in All-Star Comics number 41, June-July 1948, but helped Black Canary free the JSA from their mind control. And that's actually the issue where Black Canary earns her membership in the JSA, which ties into our last episode about Johnny Thunder, where we talked about how she kicked him out of the JSA, basically. So, Her last Golden Age appearance was in Green Lantern's last issue, number 38, May-June 1949, who by that time had surrendered the cover feature to his own dog, Streak. This is Harlequin's first appearance since that issue, so a gap of 32 years.
Daggum.
You thought Catwoman was gone for a long time in the 50s and early 60s. Yikes. Despite having a decent CV now, Sportsmaster wasn't nearly as prolific in the Golden Age. He first appeared as Crusher Croc, a disgraced athlete turned criminal in All-American Comics number 85, May 1947, created by John Broom and Irwin Hasen. He returned in Green Lantern number 28, October-November 1947, by Broom, Hasen, and Alex Toth, this time as the costume Sportsmaster. Man, those Golden Age comics, I mean, artwork by Irwin Hasen and Alex Toth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, holy cow. He and Green Lantern clashed again in All-American before his last Golden Age appearance in the aforementioned All-Star number 41, where in the Injustice Society, he met fellow member the Huntress, not that one, the tiger-striped one that Roy Thomas eventually retconned into being a heroine called the Tigress, who was in the All-Star Squadron at one point, but then becomes the Huntress. So.
Okay.
No, your head hurts. Sportsmaster and Huntress, now a wedded couple, returned in The Brave and the Bold number 62, October-November 1965, taking on Starman and Black Canary. And of course, you know that the Sportsmaster and the Huntress were part of the cast.
I know, on Stargirl.
The Stargirl TV series.
Loved that series. Yeah. I really did.
I really don't like how they ended up on that series, though. After all that, I didn't like that ending for them.
Mm-mm.
I didn't like that. I didn't like that at all. That's one of the few things they did on there that I was like, oh, you know. Because, yeah, I didn't like that. But anyway. I think Shag is pretty well covered original Green Lantern Alan Scott on this series, so we'll assume you know quite a bit about one of All-American slash DC's biggest heroes of the Golden Age and Cindy's favorite Green Lantern, so we won't go into Alan's history here. Quick note about the art. We have Dan Adkins back as inker, so the art is just pure mac and cheese comfort food. Lois and Harlequin look cute. Superman looks heroic. Everything is so clean and on model. I think it looks great. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Definitely. Clark says he was going to give the assignment to Perry White, who never ascended to editor on Earth 2.
Mm-hmm.
He was just a reporter. And actually, there was an earlier Mr. and Mrs. Superman story about that. Lois has a good point. Why is Clark worried about keeping her out of danger now? of course, he did have to save her when she got in over her head in almost every issue. But she name-dropped Superman foes like Luthor, your boy the Ultra-Humanite, the Puzzler, and the Prankster.
Yes.
Yeah, so... And, you know, she climbs inside robots and things like in the Fleischer cartoons, you know, and silly stuff like that. How about the special jewel in her ring that sends impulses to Superman if Lois feels anxiety or fear?
I like that. I mean, it's something that he can do. I mean, you would do that for me if you had that ability.
Yeah, I mean, he gave Jimmy the signal watch,
yeah.
So why not give Lois a ring, you know, like
yeah,
that? I mean,
exactly.
He should, even before he married the Earth One Superman should have done that. For Lois, even when he wasn't married, well, he never did marry her. But, you know, well,
yeah.
I mean, if you count the end of whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow, he did under a different name. But anyway, you know. But anyway. And Lois points out when he agreed to take this job at home, she's Mrs. Kent and he's Clark. But in the office, she's Lois Lane and he's the chief. You go, girl.
Well, I mean, it's one of those cases that, you know, that's the way it would have to be. I mean, I think that would have to be that way any time that you would have spouses working together. You need the division.
Right,
so.
Right. Yeah, in fact, it's probably addressed in that story where they show how Clark became the editor. I'm kind of surprised there wasn't some kind of conflict of interest with, like, the board members of the Daily Planet or whoever the publisher was about Lois, you know, about the, you know, the top reporter being married to the editor, you
mm-hmm.
know. So, but I don't know. I'm sure some people weren't happy about it that worked there, you know. Their version of Cat Grant wasn't happy about it. So.
Yeah.
So the trophies are made of actual gold and silver?
The Olympic medals are.
Yeah, and they're for an upcoming track meet. So I don't sport enough to know, but I'm guessing for things like this, they're usually just metal plated nowadays.
Exactly. I mean, they're just, you know.
But back then.
The Olympic medals were their actual gold and silver and bronze.
Ah, okay. Well, there you go. So. So they send the whole gang to look for this lighter.
Exactly.
Not really a smart move.
But that's the reason they're the criminals.
Including the Harlequin in full costume.
Yep.
I mean, I understand if she's trying to make a splash and be like, hey, I'm the Harlequin, I committed this crime. But then she goes back and like dressed as the Harlequin, you know, in that outfit. What do you think of the Harlequin's outfit?
Well, it's, you know,
looks like a Harlequin.
Yeah. Or a jester.
Looks like, yeah, I mean, it fits, you know. That's what, you know, I mean, that used to be the, kind of the silhouette on the romance books my mom used to read, the Harlequin romance, you know. So, I mean, of course, now, you know, Harlequin has been supplanted by Harley Quinn, obviously, but, you know, according to everything I've read, Harlequin's glasses hypnotize people or create illusions, but here they seem to be able to cause pain or, like, project some kind of force beam.
I know. I want to know what all powers those glasses have.
Yeah, according to Who's Who, it's literally just hypnotize people and create illusions, which is plenty. But, you know, I don't know why this guy yells, yo, you know, when she blasts him back. So, nice that Harlequin is looking out for Lois's jewelry as well as her life. But then, of course, then Lois can't contact Superman.
Which was my point.
Yeah, but yeah, and I think that's why she did it, because, you know, she is
but
not...
But then she also left her mandolin there so Lois would have access to her jewelry later,
right?
So.
I'm assuming she has another mandolin, because I think her mandolin has, like, has built-in, like, you know, like the handle extends if she needs to trip somebody.
Oh,
or,
okay.
It's tricked out, so okay. I'm assuming she's got more. But, yeah. Like you said, apparently Cal is an actual member of the gang they recognize...
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny that, you know, he's Cal and Superman is Cal,
mm-hmm.
K-A-L.
C-A-L versus K-A-L.
And in Earth 2, Superman's name is K-A-L dash just L, not E-L.
Okay.
Because that was an earlier Golden Age spelling, and Jor-El's same, you know, it's mm-hmm. the House of L is just the letter L, not E-L. EMB's got to work in the continuity, making Sportsmaster have a grudge against Harlequin for betraying the Injustice Society, which I like. He's always got to work that, you know, even in the Super Friends comic, he'd work in that continuity, which, you know, like, again, him and Roy Thomas are two birds of a feather in that way. And, you know, that, of course, there's the story that Nelson Bridwell had been the assistant to Superman editor Mort Weisinger, who apparently was just a tyrant. And Roy Thomas, like, had been corresponding with, you know, Julius Schwartz and different DC editors over the years, and, you know, was big in the fan press. And he got invited to come be Mort Weisinger's new assistant editor. He worked for him for 2 weeks and called Stan Lee and said, I can't take this. And he jumped ship to Marvel, and EMB came back and took more abuse from Mort Weisinger for years till he retired and then started working for Julius Schwartz, so... Yeah, so it's kind of funny. Their lives are strangely parallel in different points. So the heat vision trick reminds me of how John Byrne will depict it with no visible beams in a few years. Like, the gun just starts glowing red.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That was a John Byrne trick. Like, he would just show, like people with machine guns. They'd just, like, it's hot, and it'd be glowing red. And then you'd see Superman with just red eyes, not the actual connecting laser beams coming out of it. But I love Superman's...
Oh, he's a smarty pants.
Yeah, his line, bullets bouncing off the chest again. Don't you crooks ever learn? Very George Reeves.
Yeah.
Just, you know, like when they'd shoot at him and he'd go...
Yeah.
Fold his arms and just
sigh. So just over it.
Roll his eyes up in his head. And yeah, guys, I know. There's that one episode where he ducks when a guy throws a gun at him. It's a stunt man. It wasn't George Reeves himself. They should have cut that out, but George Reeves never ducked under a gun. Just like Adam West never had a gut, that's his stunt man. You can't blame him for that.
Yeah.
You know? But again, I am glad that Alan shows up, but let's see him in action. He's very passively leaning up against the wall, too, almost as if he were injured or just ran up the stairs or something.
Something, yeah.
Man, guys, I'm sorry. Ever since this whole HUAC committee thing and we broke the JSA up, I am just out of shape. I am sorry. I cannot make it up these stairs. Yeah, he just looks worn out or something. Other than that, it's fun, and Schaffenberger has a good handle on the Green Lantern cast here, I think. Alan's cape doesn't have the green interior of his cape, though. That was, you know, probably Adrian Roy just forgot. His Green Lantern symbol is the same as Hal Jordan's, not the old-fashioned Lantern. But that was pretty common at this time.
It was. They transposed it a lot.
Yeah, they did. Of course, following this, Harlequin would reemerge in the Infinity Incorporated series with issue number 9, and her and Alan Scott were wed in Infinity Incorporated annual number 1. 1985, right before the crisis on Infinite Earths occurred. Retcons and Alan's sexual orientation in recent times would complicate the nature of that relationship.
Right.
We'll take a quick promo break, then come back with your listener feedback on our second installment.
Return to the House of Frankenstein and enter its horror hall of fame.
Four fright-filled films featuring the legends of terror.
Vincent Price.
I'm going to give the people what they want. Sensation, horror, shock.
Lon Chaney Jr.
I brought that wonderful surprise I promised you.
Peter Cushing.
I know that strange, devilish forces do exist with powers beyond the comprehension of mere mortal man.
Christopher Lee.
Burn, witch, burn, witch, burn, burn, burn.
Plus your favorite superheroes battle macabre menaces.
The Fantastic Four.
The Phantom Stranger.
The Teen Titans.
And Superman.
Tell me where they are, I'll break every bone in your body.
Visit fireandwaterpodcast.com in September and October as the Supermates podcast returns for its terrifying 13th season at the House of Frankenstein.
Transmitter device activated. Coordinates set for Earth 2.
In 1961, in the pages of issue 123 of The Flash, Barry Allen, the Silver Age Flash of Earth 1, travelled to another dimension, met Jay Garrick, the Golden Age Flash of Earth 2, and the DC Multiverse as we know it was born.
And in 1985, after many years of cross-dimensional adventures, DC Comics published the cataclysmic Crisis on Infinite Earths, and the DC Multiverse was gone.
But did you know that Barry Allen's Flash was not the first hero to meet a version of himself from another dimension?
Did you know that Jay Garrick wasn't even the first Golden Age character to return in the Silver Age of comics?
The scope of the pre-crisis DC multiverse reaches far beyond Earth 1 and Earth 2.
And the legacy of DC's Golden Age characters is a lot wider than the heroes you know like Flash, Green Lantern, Sandman and Starman.
On the Earth 2 podcast, we navigate the pre-crisis DC Comics multiverse of universes and other dimensions.
And we celebrate and explore the legacy of DC's Golden Age characters, including the legendary Justice Society of America, and a lot more besides.
So join me, Peter Watson.
And me, David Steele, and our occasional guests of friends, family and fellow podcasters.
For weekly dramatic readings and analysis of the pre-crisis DC Comics multiverse and the legacy of their Golden Age characters through the Silver and Bronze Ages of comics.
On
the Earth 2 podcast.
Transmatter Cube activated. Return coordinates set for Earth Prime.
Okay, we're back, and now time to delve into the Metropolis mailbag and see what you had to say about our coverage of Superman and Lois's adventure with Johnny Thunder from Superman Family number 204.
Alan W. Wright, the bold outlaw, writes in, I remember this story very well from my childhood. Mr. and Mrs. Superman were the main reason I was buying Superman Family. Given what little percentage the stories took up in a dollar comic, that might not have been the wisest financial choice. I remember these stories much better than the Supergirl, Jimmy Olsen, Lois Lane, or Nightwing and Flamebird features. I expect I'd seen Johnny Thunder in a few JLA-JSA team-ups, but this had to have been my first major introduction to the character. Aside from the story in the JSA Digest, we wrote a letter asking Superman to take his place at a JSA meeting because he had a cold. So for me, this is the defining story for Johnny, and helped solidify my sense that he was an idiot. I also remember his diminishing JSA retcon, in the original sense, a green retcon, I believe, as I once wrote an online post comparing types of retcons to colors of kryptonite. I certainly recognize EMB was using it to give an in-story explanation for the character's publishing history, but I also appreciated that. These are fun tales, and you are the perfect host to cover them. Well, thank you, Alan. And Alan actually shared his different color of recons versus kryptonite colors in the thread, so I recommend everybody check that out. It's really quite brilliant. Color's brilliant. But no, it's really well thought out, and I really like it. And yeah, that story where Johnny sends Superman a message saying, hey, can you take my place? That was the issue of All-Star where Superman and Batman actually participated in a true case that you always see with them marching with Wonder Woman, and they're holding the banner, and they made a Hallmark ornament of it, which I think it was out last year, but I didn't see it till this year.
Right.
So, yeah.
Okay. Mark Baker Wright writes in, I'm mostly struck by the fact that Johnny asked for help from the superhero with an extremely well-documented weakness to magic.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, it's on the back of Superman's superpowers file card, right? So, mm-hmm. Yeah. Rich writes in, despite having worked with both Dr. Fate and the Spectre himself, either of whom ought to be able to take the shaman out without batting an eye, I could see being merciful and not calling in the Spectre, who tends to overdo things, but that doesn't really explain why he didn't yell for Dr. Fate. Yeah, that is a good point. I mean, he was way more familiar with those two characters mm-hmm. than Superman and Lois, so that, kind of good point, yeah.
Okay, Rob Kelly. I think I know that fella.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
It occurred to me during this episode how it was a real missed opportunity that we didn't get an Earth 2 Superman-Batman team-up in their final Grain Temple's half-retired form. They're both married men. Might have been quite interesting fodder for a story or two. Surely Red Tornado or Green Arrow could have given up their slot in one issue of World's Finest, which of course starred them both until the Silver Age changeover, to make room for this. I looked at the scans you posted and thought, why does this look a little off? I normally love Schaffenberger's artwork, but then I saw the inker, Frank Chiaramonte. Sigh. Glad to have the show back. See you next April.
No, see, we're back in August. Or, mm-hmm. it'd still be August when this drops. So, although we recorded a little behind the scenes, we recorded this feedback part later than the actual episode. But yeah, no, we're back. We're back sooner. We're trying to do this on a quarterly-esque basis here. Quarterly-esque basis. But yeah, the only time I really saw Superman and Batman team up in their Graying Temple era was weirdly enough, like around the time of I think Infinite Crisis and George Perez drew an issue where they fought the Gentleman Ghost. You know, our friend the Gentleman Ghost, and I put friend in quotes. But it was odd since, you know, Earth 2 continuity should have been gone, but that's when they were reestablishing that Power Girl really was from Earth 2.
Right.
And, of course, they brought Earth 2 Superman back in Infinite Crisis only to kill him, which was... but don't get me started. Anyway, Mike Thomas writes in, great discussion. This is such a fun series to cover. I remember reading these back in the day. I like the idea that this is loosely part of the same continuity as the George Reeves series. Looking forward to your next one. Well, it's very loosely just in my head canon, but yeah, it you know, I like it too. I like the way that works.
Okay, Ryan Daly, somebody else we kind of know, a little bit.
I think so.
I'm convinced the best version of Johnny Thunder and the Thunderbolt is actually Lilo and Stitch. Great episode.
Sure. Yeah, that's true. And you know, I doubt a Johnny Thunder live action movie would make $1 billion like the Lilo and Stitch movie did. So yeah, good point. Anthony Cardinal writes in, hi Chris and Cindy, I'm so glad you're continuing the series. The Mr. and Mrs. Superman feature was always my favorite part of Superman Family, followed closely by Nightwing and Flamebird. I just recently finished rebuilding an entire set of Superman Family and am looking forward to diving back into it. Although if I read them in order, it'll be a while before I get to the Mr. and Mrs. Superman issues. I think one of you mentioned how good E. Nielsen Bridwell was at writing retcons that work so well. Johnny's history in this story, the Kents attending the Wayne wedding in your previous episode, even the Kid Eternity Captain Marvel Jr. connection. He really, I think, did retcons better than anyone else at DC. I'm a big Roy Thomas fan, but I think we can all agree some of the retcons were needlessly convoluted and or icky, that Black Canary origin you also mentioned. Looking forward to finding out which Mr. and Mrs. Superman tale you cover next. Well, now you know which one we cover next, the Harlequin tale. But yeah, I think E and B maybe had a little bit better handle on, you know, he put the a round peg into a round hole, while Roy sometimes hammered a, you know, round peg into a square hole, or vice versa, or something like that. You know, he sometimes forced things a little much, I think. Rob McCarthy also wrote in, well, thank God we know what happened to Johnny's belt. No, I don't remember a belt. They didn't even mention the belt much in this Who's Who entry. You guys might not like everybody with the same name is related, but a 13-year-old me loved trying to write Robot Man and Robin having a family picnic, but then I found out the original Robot Man was a comedy. I can't put Robin in a comedy. Frank Miller might read it. That's all the Batman 66 stuff. That's clearly a comedy. But yeah, I get it. Yeah. You know, when I was a kid, I liked everybody being related to, but now I'm just like, it just makes the universe so much smaller, you know? So, I mean, there's times I do like it, but, you know, like, honestly, Ted Knight and Sandra Knight, you know, Phantom Lady and Starman being cousins, you know, especially where they were at different companies originally, and, you know.
Well, I mean, it's just kind of like having the comic book world set in Kentucky. Everybody's related to somebody somehow.
Yeah, and some of them are cousins, and they're still got married. But anyway, no, I'm just kidding.
Nate the Great writes in, Wade's World's Finest had Mixus Pitalik and Johnny Thunder's Thunderbolt from the same dimension. George Perez's Earth 2 Superman definitely did look like George Reeves.
Okay, yeah, I couldn't, you know, I read World's Finest, but I've read so much of it now, I'm starting to kind of forget certain issues. But yeah, that might be where I was remembering where they were supposed to be from the same dimension. And I think when Morrison did the JSA crossover story in JLA in the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, I think the Thunderbolt was supposed to be all B and Quisp, where they were all from like the same dimension, I think, but I could be wrong. Ito Bosner writes in, excellent, the second annual installment of the Mr. and Mrs. Superman show. A nice mid-year fix before the next House of Frankenstein. I kid. Hey, we're back right before House of Frankenstein. See, people, you non-believers, we did it. Enjoyed the show, though, and enjoyed the story so kindly provided on the gallery page. Yes, it's a bit silly, but also quite fun. And Lois looked quite fetching in the genie getup. I'm betting that when they got home and she wanted to change, Soup said, no hurry there, Lois.
Oh, my.
As long as he didn't say, call me master, you know, or something like that.
Brett Miller writes in, I actually discovered this network due to your Starman work. This is an excuse to ask for a raise. My main takeaway from this episode, other than loving Cindy's accent, you've got one too, is the theme song. For a few minutes, I could have sworn it was an old Roy Rogers song. For me, that's the highest praise possible.
Well, you got to give props to our friend Terry O'Malley, a.k.a. Ward Hill Terry. That was all Terry. He heard I was going to do Mr. and Mrs. Superman. I'd announced it, and he sent me that theme just out of nowhere, and he did the same thing for our House of Frankenstein series. Terry is way too generous with his enormous musical talent, so you got to give him all the props. I had absolutely nothing to do with that theme song. I just use it because I love it, and it's great. And Starman, one of these days me and Cindy would like to get back to doing the Starman Chronicles. It's just so much work. It's such a dense book. But keep your ears peeled to this very show, and you might hear me and a certain other person talk about Starman, the James Robinson Starman series. Just throwing that out there. So, Bucky749 writes in, I've listened to some of your shows, but I tend not to comment. I believe Peachy Pitt did return, at least in name and later JSA run, as Johnny mentioned her running a successful ice cream shop, so she never became a hero. But Johnny did later adopt another daughter later in life. Sadly, we never got a comic of Johnny's two daughters interacting. With all the facsimiles, we need some more of the All Flash comics. Can you say the names of the issues where Peachy Pitt first appeared again, and the issue where Black Canary shows? Maybe the Fire and Water Network, Ken, will make it happen. The JLA 200 Treasury just happened. So, yeah, we'll try to, you know, mention these things more and see if we can make them materialize. Why we can't make more important things materialize, because we gripe and complain about that too. But, you know, but that we don't have that power. But, my bad. Even though I followed along with Shag's coverage of the 90s JSA series, the Len Straduski, Mike Parabek series, and I read it when it came out, I forgot that Peachy Pet had opened a Froyo place, and actually Johnny made a ton of money off that, you know.
Oh.
So they invested in it, she ran it, and when he came back, he was rich. When he came back from limbo, so.
Okay, Joe X writes in, Peachy Pet appeared in the Parabek Drawn Justice Society series and was running a chain of frozen yogurt shops. Like you said, she then showed up in JSA 78 through 80, where she had been turned into a djinn and married Shaco, the Thunderbolt's son. I loved Mr. and Miss Superman, and it was the only reason I bought Superman Family. In addition, the Thin Man in the Adventures of Superman, it also reminded me of I Love Lucy.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, and I apologize, Joe X. I forgot you basically said the same thing I did just a minute ago.
Yeah.
So my apologies for that. But that was my bad for completely spacing. I think it's because I never, like, glommed on to, like, a visual of Peachy Pet, like, beyond. I've seen a few Golden Age stories, what she looked like as a kid, but I couldn't tell you what she looked like as an adult. So I think that's part of it. I think that's part of the problem. But, yeah, there is a little bit of an I Love Lucy vibe, but thankfully Lois isn't shown as being inept as Lucy, you know, and And also, I mean, although in this story, there's a little bit of, I guess, even more of a Lucy vibe because, you know, Superman's basically like, yeah, Clark's like, I don't want you getting in trouble. And she's like, but I was doing this before we got married. But then she does end up getting in trouble. And both Superman and Green Lantern basically have to, and a little with the help from Harlequin, have to save her. So I guess there's a little bit more of that in this one, but I hope, you know, we don't ever get to the point where she's crying at the end and
Ricky!
And so you got a lot of splaining to do or something. Like, I hope we don't get to that. So, but Jason Keen writes in, oh my goodness, you two have unlocked a core comic book memory for me. After hearing you describe it and looking at the images on the site, I was instantly brought back to my early childhood. This must have been one of the few superhero books I had in the pile of Richie Rich and Archie comics my mother bought me at a yard sale when I was either 4 or 5 years old. I'm pretty sure my copy had the cover, at least for a while, but I definitely remember the interior. The Thunderbolt gave me the creeps thanks to his pointy ears and demonic lightning bolts coming from his head. Although I did like that Lois Lane veiled outfit for reasons I couldn't quite understand at the time. This was an awakening for a lot of people, I think.
Apparently.
Yeah. I'm so happy to finally understand the story. I may have been too young to read this at the time. I will definitely be on the lookout for this issue the next time I visit a comic shop with an extensive back issue room. I look forward to listening to future episodes and maybe rediscovering other lost treasures from my childhood. You know, that is a great feeling. I've had that many times over the years, just looking. I remember, and I have one now, but I remember early on, it was either online or in a toy book, I saw the Remco Spider-Man helicopter, like the big helicopter they made. They made so you could put Mego figures in it, even though they weren't Mego. They you know, it was made by it was Empire. Not Remco, Empire. Made by Empire. That also made blow molds, which I collect, and my ride on Batmobile and stuff. But the Empire spider copter I had as a kid, and I saw that in a book, and it, like, literally unlocked all these memories I had. Like, oh my God, I remember that, and now I own one again, because I found one at a vintage toy shop for a decent price. But yeah, that is a wonderful feeling when that happens. So I'm glad we could help you with that. That made my day to read that, because that is a wonderful feeling. So,
Super Captain writes in, so glad to hear this show again. I like Johnny Thunder and just try to forget the Justice League number 219 through 220 ever happened. This story is fun, although Bridwell went a long way in those last two panels for that joke. Mm-hmm. And yes, Chris, I did listen to this with my lovely wife, which is why I probably shouldn't mention that Lois's harem outfit reminds me of the Terry Hatcher Lois dressing as a belly dancer on a first season episode of Lois and Clark. She would surely give me a Cindy-like punch in the shoulder.
Hey, you know, me and Cindy were dating at the time, but I'd made no bones about it. I found Terry Hatcher very attractive as Lois Lane. So, you know, I mean, I did, you know. She was the original internet girl, right? I mean, when the internet was, like, first taken off, Terry Hatcher was, like, the most downloaded picture, you know, on the internet. So, you get a Terry Hatcher pass there. If you still like Dean Cain, though, I don't want to talk to you. Sorry.
Fair.
Paul Kean writes in from our very network and the host of the DC Special Cast. Say you guys, sorry I'm late to the party, just caught up and highly enjoyed this episode. Charming is the perfect word for all the stories of Mr. and Mrs. Superman, including this one. I bought and read Superman Family as it came out, despite some of it being a tough read at times. But I always loved this feature, and so glad you're back to it. I can't say I was ever a fan of Johnny Thunder, though. Some of his last appearances were in the Black Canary Archives, which is a great book. He was kind of a loser even then. Anyway, great to hear the two of you together. Yeah, Johnny, I mean, I don't hate Johnny. But I don't, like, I get why some people really just don't like Johnny. You know, it's like, and he's like, you know, he kind of sort of deserves to be the punching bag he is, but he kind of, I don't know, I'm on the fence. I can take him or leave him, but I like this story, so anyway.
Okay. Shag, that one I just want to just get, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, hi Chris and Cindy. I showed up in the comment section to mention that the 1992 Justice Society of America series by Straczynski and Paperback and the connection with Peachy Pet and the Frozen Yogurt franchise, but everyone already beat me to it. Gotta be used to that by now. I'll just add that Johnny Thunder invested in the Froyo stores before going to Ragnarok, so when the JSA returned, his investment had made him rich. Finally, this episode was wonderful. Such a joyful listen, and looking forward to more.
You just awakened some people with your rolling R just then, too, I think, maybe.
Oh, how perfect.
Thank you, Arthur Kitt. John Stive, who I had the pleasure of podcasting with on a recent podcast, which may or may not be out by now, but I won't say what it is. But yeah, we got to podcast together, and he was quite the nice fellow, I will say. John says, I know I'm really late in commenting, but I wanted to reread all the other comments just to be sure. I will once again state that I like Johnny Thunder and his Thunderbolt. He was always comedic relief to me. He was also a guy like the people who read the comics, just a regular guy. And I like his first name, too. Well, yeah, it makes sense. I screw up so much on a daily basis that I like the idea of this goofy guy with a magic genie who does the same. He and I would have way more in common than me and somebody like Hawkman, even though I love me some Hawkman. So go easy on Johnny, people. Say you, please. Yeah, I mean, like I said, here's somebody defending Johnny, and that's great. Somebody, you know, that it's okay if you like Johnny, that's great. If you don't, you know, he's a divisive figure. But yeah, I think we'd all say we have more in common with Johnny than the guy who is either a reincarnated prince of Egypt or thinks he is, like is how they kind of did it in the Golden Age series by Robinson, where everybody's like, you're leaning into this a little too much, Carter, you know, nowadays. But So that will do it for this time. We'll be back soon with another JSA-related adventure for Mr. and Mrs. Superman.
A big thanks to our friend Terry O'Malley, a.k.a. Ward Hill Terry, for his wonderful Mr. and Mrs. Superman theme you heard at the beginning of this episode. Terry also provides our House of Frankenstein theme over on our Supermate show. Follow Terry's band, Stop Calling Me Frank, on their Facebook page. Check the show notes for more info.
This episode is sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Running the Fire & Water Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. A while back, we realized that we needed some help with the expenses, so we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. If you are enjoying the Justice Society Presents podcast feed, the best way to support the show is by visiting patreon.com/FWPodcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the Fire & Water Podcast Network. At certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on the show of your choice. Just like our All-Star Squadron here, who has to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents podcast. Our thanks go out to Alex Osias,
Bill Baer,
Bruno Diaz,
Chris Mort,
Craig Fletcher,
DC Dave,
Devin Clancy,
George Van Note,
Jason Keene,
Jeffrey Owens,
Jordan Jennings,
Keith G. Baker,
Kevin Witter,
Mark Baker Wright,
Matt Ev,
Michael Bailey,
Michael Crouch,
Mike Zumkowski,
Roger Preeb,
Little Russell Burbage, my buddy.
Yeah, symbol pending.
Ted Kilvington.
And Tim Price. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcast. Cindy and I will be heading back to the House of Frankenstein over on our Supermates podcast during September and October for our 13th annual Halloween extravaganza. There we discuss a classic or classic-themed horror film and a superhero comic with a similar threat or vibe. A couple of JSA foes often crash the recording, so check it out if you haven't. Hopefully we'll be back to 344 Clinton Street before the end of 2026. Until then, thank you for listening, and be sure to check out all the other shows on the Justice Society Presents feed.
Bye.
Don't miss the next thrill-packed episode in the amazing adventures of Superman. Superman is based on the original character appearing in Superman magazine.